The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
Welcome to our latest podcast. If I can, I'd like to give a plug for a previous podcast before we get started here today. I saw a preview of a movie that's coming out on DVD and coming out on pay-per-view or whatever you call it, on demand, called The Lost City of Z. And it's about someone kind of at the turn of the century. It's based on a true story who was trying to find the Lost City of Z, the city of gold in South America, and explore. And we had someone on a few months ago on episode number 7 of Travel with Hawkeye, the podcast, by the name of William Carlson. And he had a book about a similar group of explorers. The book is called Jungle of Stone, The Extraordinary Journey of John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood, and their discovery of the lost civilizations of the Maya. And they're actually the ones that discovered the Mayan temples in Central America and Mexico. And it's a fascinating read. It's a fascinating book. And William Carlson went and retraced their steps. Stevens and Catherwood, their lives were incredible. They changed pretty much the perception of the indigenous people of this continent with their discovery of the Mayans. And there really were rumors, basically, of these temples, and they're the ones that found them. It's called, as I said, Jungle of Stone. It's episode number 7 of Travel with Hawkeye. So if you are interested in that movie, The Lost City of Z, and you want to find out more about explorers of that time, check out our podcast, Travel with Hawkeye, episode 7. You can find all those at travelwithhawkeye.net. We're also on iTunes and easy to find. Now, today on the podcast, there is a show on PBS that starts on July 18th, and it's going to air for 3 consecutive weeks. It's called Rare Creatures of the Photo Ark. Joel Satori is joining us. It's also a book called Rare Creatures of the Photo Ark, and his mission is really to take photographs of animals that are in captivity that are on the endangered species list and may not be around for a very long time. It's a very interesting endeavor. He's traveled the world to find these animals in zoos and preserves all over the planet, and we'll talk to Joel in just a few minutes. Also, we'll be talking to Michael Bremer, and Michael is the vice president of Experian, and their identity theft company. The reason I asked him on the podcast is when you travel, how you pay for things is kind of a big deal. And many years ago, you would go to the American Express office and get traveler's checks. I actually remember, I think it was my first time going overseas as an adult, getting traveler's checks. And then I think you had to sign them twice into the country that you were at, and you'd get, it was an interesting way to travel. But I mean, you know, you used to have to get different currencies for every country. There was no such thing as the euro, or you would take cash over, you would hide it in your shoe, and then you would go to some type of, there would be all over the place, there would be these currency exchange booths, and you would look for the best deal, and it was always fluctuating. They still have them, they're just not as prominent as they used to be, because now you could literally go to an ATM and get euros out of the ATM, and you're not really sure how much money you're taking out of your account back home, because you're not really doing the math. I remember the first time that I discovered that I could actually use my ATM card overseas. I was in Austria, and I was laughing with another traveler of mine. He was from South Africa, and we're kind of joking. It was like we were getting Monopoly money out, because we weren't really sure how much money we were taking from our account with this Austrian mark. Now it's a little bit different. You can actually use your credit card overseas, and they recommend that's a good way to do it. But is it? Is that the best way to do it? Or maybe take money out of your debit card when you go overseas? We got the chip now. Does the chip work the same way here in the U.S. as it does in Europe? So we'll ask him about that. It's a really important lesson if you're about ready to travel overseas. What's the best way to pay for things when you get over there? So we'll talk to Michael in just a few minutes. But first of all, we've got Joel on the phone. Joel Satori is from the new PBS feature, the PBS television show Rare Creatures of the Photo Ark, and also the book Rare Creatures of the Photo Ark. And Joe, I have to say, this endeavor that you're going on, it's very interesting, but there's also a profound sadness to it. Do you get that reaction from other people who talk about this program?
Well, no, it's pretty common if we're looking just at the species for which there's really no hope of recovery. The show has a couple of animals in it that will probably go extinct. But it also looks a lot at the work that people are doing around the world to save species that got close but are rebounding.
All right.
So there's a lot of hope there, and there's a lot of inspiration. And And we just use the the tough ones, the ones that could go extinct. We use those as inspirational tools too, because we want to teach the world that this is life and death, and that as these other animals go away, so could we.
All right, so let's just give a broad overview on what this project is. We kind of touched on it a little, but it's about extinct creatures. But what you're doing and how grand this project actually is.
Right. Well, the photo arc is a 25-year effort on my part to document every captive animal around the world, every animal in human care, at aquariums, zoos, wildlife, rehabbers, private breeders, you name it. And the goal really is to get the public to care about the extinction crisis while there's still time to save everything. We photograph rare and common animals today, and we just want people to fall in love with these animals and learn they exist. We want to give them a reference point in a way, and allow them to see that there's so much more to the world's animals than just gorillas and polar bears. There's all sorts of amazing things out there that need our attention.
All right, so this is a book, first of all, and now it's a PBS special, is that correct?
Right. Well, we've been working on this 11 years now, so the PBS show, the book, there's an outdoor exhibition traveling the nation's zoos, lots of things going on, but we figure it'll take, we've been at it 11 years, we have 6,500 portraits, studio portraits, of different animals to date, and we figure we'll need another 15 years and we'll get all 13,000 species in human care around the world.
Wow, this has really become your life's work.
It has, yeah. We use studio portraits as a way of getting the reader engaged with the animal by looking them in the eye. And they're on black and white backgrounds to eliminate all distractions and also to give every animal an equal voice. In these portraits, there's no size comparison. So an elephant is every bit as big as an elephant is no more important than a mouse. And a tiger beetle counts as much as a tiger because everything's the same size.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, let's talk a little about first your background, how you got interested in this, and how did it all begin?
Sure. I was a National Geographic magazine photographer for about 15 years. Still am. But about 12 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's fine now, but it forced me to take a year and just be at home and take care of her and our three kids, and I had a year to sit and think about what to do with the second half of my life, and came up with this project, just figuring this would last a lot longer than just a magazine story that comes and goes in a month. So that's how the photo arc was founded.
All right, so you started to literally travel the world. You have traveled the world in search of these endangered species, correct?
Right, that's right, all over. Just for this show, the PBS folks were with me for the better part of 18 months. And we went to Madagascar and Cameroon, the Czech Republic, New Zealand, just all over the place, several spots in the U.S., to show people some of the rarest animals in the world and the people that are working real hard to save them.
Okay, now these animals that are in captivity now, I guess I'm going to lead to the first question is, I want to go to Prague first, because the animal that was in captivity in Prague isn't from Prague, and there's only three of these left in the world.
Right, and that was actually at the Dvor Králové Zoo in the Czech Republic, and that is the northern white rhino. And at the time we filmed this, that she was a single old female at this zoo. And she was quite old, and she was sleeping all the time, and we barely got to her. I mean, she died, I think, a week later. But she stood up, and she grazed for a while on our black background, and we got portraits of her. And now the world just has three left, all in a pen in Kenya, and they're too old to breed.
Oh.
That's really the last, that's at the very last moment you can photograph an animal. And we do show some of that, but we want people to know that there's tons of stuff we all can do to save species. And it starts with how we live our lives at home in terms of our carbon footprint, the kind of foods we eat, the products we buy. And also a great idea is to become a member of your local zoo or aquarium or nature center, because they're already doing great work. They're all conservation centers in their own ways. For a lot of the animals I photograph now, they only exist in zoos or aquariums. They're gone in the wild. And so these places are great places to support and also to bring children so that they care about nature too, growing up.
Let's talk a little bit about the zoos. Did you encounter any species that are only in zoos, but they hope to reintroduce the species into the wild?
Oh, yeah, many. There's animals like the Salt Creek tiger beetle, which the Omaha Zoo and the Lincoln Children's Zoo are breeding. That's down to hardly anything in the wild, but they're breeding them in captivity now. The Florida grasshopper sparrow is another one that's down to maybe 30 birds in the wild, but they have an equal number or greater in captive breeding programs. So these are small numbers, but they matter a lot in case the population in the wild fails. There's a captive population that can replace it. We see that a lot, unfortunately, and probably only see it increase unless people start to think more about how we're all connected to nature and things we can do to save them. I mean, it's key going forward. It's pretty obvious to me that we have to have a sea change in how the public views its relationship to nature. I mean, we have to have bees and butterflies to pollinate fruits and vegetables that we eat. We have to have intact rainforests to bring us rain where we know how to grow crops. So it's all tied together, and maybe getting people into the tent of conservation is just to get them hooked on one animal or another that's come into the photo arc. That's what we hope anyway.
Let me ask you a couple questions here about what we can do. You said one thing is locally you can join your own zoo, and because they have efforts there. That's a great thing. But you also mentioned your products that you buy. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, you bet. Well, let's start with your yard. If you're buying chemicals that you put on your lawn, you're poisoning everybody and everything. I mean, insecticides, herbicides, those end up in our drinking water. They don't just stay in your grass. They migrate out. And so you're not just killing the stuff that lives in your yard. You're making all of us sick. So that's a good place to start. And planting a butterfly garden in your backyard, something for butterflies and bees with milkweed and nectar-bearing plants. People can go to monarchwatch.org. That's a nonprofit, monarchwatch.org. They can learn what plants to plant in their part of the country. And then as you move inside your house, have you insulated your home well? Do you throw a lot of carbon into the air because your home's not insulated? Well, that helps warm the earth. That's not a good thing. And the products you buy, as you mentioned, what's that dining room set made out of? What's that bedroom set made out of? If it's made of tropical hardwoods, then that's forest we can't afford to lose. If you're buying a lot of meat, meat takes a lot of water and a lot of grain to produce. Maybe eat a little less meat. And also watch the stuff that's made out of palm oil. There's vast tracts of rainforest in Asia that's being cut down to start up palm oil plantations. That's very hard on the tropical rainforest that we need to regulate our atmosphere and our rainfall. So it takes a little bit of effort, takes a little bit of studying, but really an hour on the internet, you can brush up and realize that what you do in terms of your consumer choices are really big deals in the long run.
You know, interesting thing that you point out about pesticides on your own lawn and everything. I mean, a great lesson that we learned as a society is DDT. At one time, that was thought of a savior. But then we started to see that chemical being passed from one part of the food chain to another. And then it started showing up in all sorts of things. And it went all the way to the bald eagle. I mean, that, you know, eggshells were very difficult for, you know, it started deteriorating eggshells, and it just decimated that population.
Right. That's right. DDT in the atmosphere not only thinned the eggshells of raptors trying to sit on eggs, the eggs would break. But it showed up in human breast milk.
Yes.
And that's what really got people turned around thinking, whoa, this isn't a good thing. Well, you know, there's lots of other chemicals that we're putting on, you know, on lawns that are really not good. I mean, it doesn't just stay there. So people just need to realize, you know what, keep your lawn mowed, keep it tidy, but don't throw all those chemicals on your lawn. That's a huge impact you could have to benefit the environment and your neighbors and any towns downstream that are receiving water that comes from your area.
Let's talk a little bit more about the species that are in your book, Rare, and also on the PBS special, The Photo Arc. One is in Spain, the Iberian lynx, and there are very few of these left also.
That's right. That's an unusual one. It's kind of like a big version of a bobcat that we'd have in North America. Very rare animal. They've got a captive breeding program that's going great. That animal was virtually wiped out because a scientist decided that he didn't like rabbits in his yard eating his vegetables. So he released a rabbit with a virus, and that virus killed out not only the rabbits in his yard, but rabbits all over the Iberian Peninsula. And rabbits are what Iberian lynx eat the most. And so it without any prey, they starve to death. And they're starting to rebuild the rabbit population in these areas, and the lynx are coming back. But there's a good news. There's a success story. That's an animal that was down to just about nothing. And thanks to the efforts of people who cared, they're making a comeback. So that was kind of a nice one.
There is a similar animal to that, like in South Texas, called the ocelot. Have you heard of that?
Right. I have, and we photographed those for the photo arc and also in the wild using camera traps along the border. And, yeah, they're fairly common once you get south of the U.S., but in the U.S., it's really a rare animal. Fewer than 20, I think, are believed to exist in this country.
Another animal that, and I don't know if this is, I'm just throwing out animals here because I'm fascinated by this, in Hawaii is the monk seal.
Yeah, the Hawaiian monk seal. That's something, several of the monk seal, I think a couple of the monk seal species have gone extinct already. That's an animal that is, that's protected, federally protected, but, you know, it has to deal with pollution, strikes by boats or ships, and habitat degradation. It needs lots of pristine coastline to live. And I think I photographed that after the show up at the Minneapolis Zoo, the Minnesota Zoo in Minneapolis. It's a great animal.
It really is. You know, and the interesting thing about Hawaii, a lot of people don't realize this, there are very few natural mammals that are native to Hawaii. One is the monk seal, and the other is a bat, and that's it.
Right, and it's similar to New Zealand, believe it or not. They had, in terms of their native mammals, I think they had a bat or two and dolphins. Many of these island chains, mammals couldn't make it. Mammals can't swim very well, and they can't fly very well unless you're a bat. And all their creatures evolved without mammalian predators. And so when you get mammals onto an island like that, you get big trouble in terms of extinction.
Boy, that's an interesting thing, too, is invasive species, introducing another species to an area, and it can totally change the animals, the habitat. And a great, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this, is what happened in Guam with the tree snake.
Yeah, the brown tree snake. I just photographed that one at the Omaha Zoo. That is an animal that has really devastated not only animals on the ground, but it climbs trees, and it empties nests of chicks and eggs. So that has wiped out tons of animals in Guam. And, yeah, it just shows you, if you bring an animal from another country in to an area where it doesn't have any natural predators of its own, it can really take over and wreak havoc.
And, you know, sometimes it's brought over accidentally. What's happening all over the U.S., and it just finally came to my area of the country, is something called the zebra mussel. And that's taking over area lakes. And they're slowly finding it more and more lakes. And I've seen it up north, and it is a horrible, horrible thing to have in your lake.
Yeah, it is. And it plugs up infrastructure. It gets on boats. It gets on drains for dams and pipes and kills out your native mussels. And I've seen pictures where there are hundreds of zebra mussels on the shell of one big native mussel. And the reason this isn't good is because, you know, mussels filter our water. They act as kind of an aquatic canary in a coal mine. They tell us when things aren't going well. And zebra mussels they're really, really tough to control. They were brought over in ship's ballast water.
Yeah, that's what I hear,
Yeah.
Well, you said there were some species that you have photographed, not many, but a few that have gone extinct since you photographed.
Yeah.
What would those be?
Well, probably the most famous one is the Rab's fringed limb tree frog. There was one old male living at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, and they named him Tuffy because he outlived all life expectancy predictions, and he died last summer. And that's an animal that was wiped out by a fungus that's sweeping the world, called chytrid fungus, and he's from Panama. They brought a few into captivity. They got some eggs and they got some tadpoles, but, you know, they had to get it right the first time. Biologists did, and they didn't know what those tadpoles ate or what type of water they needed. It was all experimental, and none of the tadpoles made it. So they got down to that one animal, and, yeah, he passed away last summer, and so that's it. And I show Tuffy in every talk I give, and I try to get people to think, well, you know, one animal going away, we can survive that. But, like rivets popping out of an airplane wing, how many do you want to lose? I mean, how many does it take before entire ecosystems fail? People forget that our food doesn't just come from the grocery store. We need a healthy planet to grow our food. The air we breathe, the water we drink, these things have to be fairly clean for us to survive. And so we're on track now to lose half of all species by the turn of the next century. That's a very broad generalization. Could be worse than that. And we need to be thinking, you know, as these things go away, so could we. So we show Tuffy, we show the other animals like there's several different types of frogs that have gone away. There's a rabbit called the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit that's gone extinct. There's several insects. These are small things now, but we really want to try to beat the drum a bunch and see if people will care about what's happening to the biodiversity around them. I think they will care, and I think they'll want to help, but they have to know these problems exist. And we're so distracted now by politics and other things that we just aren't paying attention to the right things. And so hopefully the photo arc will help people do just that.
And the photo arc, as we said earlier, is not only a book, but also a three-part PBS series. So what will we see in the first? They air on July 18th is the first day of it. Mm-hmm. And then it airs on the next Tuesday after that and the Tuesday after that. What will we see on episode 1, 2, and 3?
Well, I tell you, I know that the first one opens with a hornbill that's trying to break my camera. So people will find that very amusing, I think. He was the toughest bird I ever had to photograph by far, and the PBS crew was with me at the time. So that, I know, is the first one, and they've had several versions of it that I've looked at over time, so I don't know exactly how the other segments evolve, but I know they're leading the whole show with what's my... It's my favorite segment by far of the hornbill, because he kind of wins in the end, and that's fine. I mean, he had a great time. He had a great time.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating work, and as I said before, there's a bit of sadness to it too, and yeah. but also a cultural awareness of what we need to do as a people to preserve habitats and species, which is in no one's interest to lose.
That's right. No, I mean, as they go, so do we. So we do need to pay attention and listen to them and just make sure that we save big chunks of habitat. That's the big thing, because it cleans our air and our water and stabilizes the rainfall we get. So those are big, big issues that we're not talking about yet. And I realize that true change is generational, but I can't wait. You know, I want to see things get started now, and so that's what the photo arc's about.
All right. It's called Rare Creatures of the Photo Arc. It's a new three-part PBS series. It premieres July 18th on PBS. And also the book, Rare Creatures of the Photo Arc, Joel Satori. Joel, thank you so much for your time. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right, shifting gears, we've got Michael Bremer on the line. He's Vice President of Identity Protection at Experian. And I asked him here because when you travel, you got to figure out how you're going to spend money. I mean, you got to buy food, you got to get transportation, all sorts of things you want to spend money on. There was a day that you get traveler's checks before you went overseas. Now you can get money out of the ATM machine with your debit card, or you can use your credit card. What really is the best way to pay for things? Is you just stuff a lot of cash in your shoe and exchange for a local currency when you get there? And that's what I wanted to talk to Michael about today. Michael, I mean, do people even use traveler's checks anymore?
Well, interestingly enough, and first of all, Mark, thanks for having me on the show, on the podcast. The thing about traveler's checks is less than 40% of all transactions are done by traveler's checks. So they're a dying breed, although they are actually one of the most secure means, because the companies that back the traveler's checks will give you a guarantee if they get stolen. So those are the most secure means. The least secure would actually be your ATM card, because it's just like a debit card. So if that information, whether it was stolen through a skimmer or you lost it and someone used it, they would have direct access to your account, and the liability limits are generally higher or non-existent with debit cards. So I would always recommend using a credit card, and especially whether you're traveling overseas or you're using the internet to purchase things, I would have a separate credit card with a low limit just to protect you in any case that the information on that card was compromised.
Oh, so maybe even a special credit card that you only use to travel.
Correct.
Oh, that's an interesting way to do that. Yes, yes. Okay, let me ask you this too, because this is so confusing to me. Last time, or a couple times ago when I went to Europe, they were into the chip. And the chip is totally different than this new chip that I have on my card now. It worked totally different. In fact, like I went to a restaurant, the waiter actually came to the table with a small little device and asked me to punch in my chip code or my PIN number, which I didn't have, and they looked at me like I was from a foreign planet and walked away with my card and stuff. But I understand now that the chips that we have, they don't work the same way they do in Europe. Is that correct?
No, most of the new technology, the chip and PIN card, is In the U.S., it's really not chip and PIN. It's chip and signature because the transaction process is faster and it would require more security and more expense for the banks and issuing institutions to process those. So in the States, we have chip and signature. That's why if you actually go over through that same transaction you described that you had in Europe a few years back, they'll bring you the device to your table. You put it in. It will read the chip, but then you still have to go ahead and sign the printed receipt that comes out of the machine versus someone in Europe that would punch in their PIN card, which is actually a little bit more secure than the signature because someone could forge your signature.
Mm-hmm.
That's the current state with the EMV transaction, and that's the EMV stands for European MasterCard Visa Protocol. We call it chip and PIN.
Okay, so basically, what you're saying is I'm still going to get I'm still going to get the European eye roll when I hand them my American credit card when the next time I go overseas.
Yeah, and that's not just because you're an American either.
It's just because of the credit card. Now, if you do go overseas and you are you think that you are a victim of identity theft when you're over there because of your credit card or your PIN number or something, do you have to wait till you get back to America, or are there steps you need to take immediately even though you're in Paris or wherever?
Well, first of all, before you go, Mark, I think it's always really important before you travel that you make copies of your important documents. So anything that you're carrying in your wallet, and for sure don't carry your Social Security card or anything that you absolutely don't need, but let's say it's a medical insurance card, your passport, driver's license, and copy of your credit card numbers and the phone numbers on the back of those cards to call in any case, and take a copy of that in a separate place outside your purse, put it in your suitcase, so that if for some reason your purse or your wallet gets compromised, you've got copies of that. Because immediately you can contact your bank or the institution and say, hey, I've had my wallet stolen, or I've lost the cards or lost the passport, and you can start the process of, first of all, shutting it down, or in the case like a passport, which you need to get home, you can get one reissued by the embassy. Now, in the case of having identity theft protection, like our Experian Identity Works product, you have access to a fraud resolution agent that can do that on your behalf and work through that. But in absence of that, if you're doing it yourself, it's still good to have a backup of all those documents.
That's a very good advice. I always photocopy my passport, too, in case that gets lost or stolen. And I do notice that Americans are more concerned about their passport than people in other countries. And I think that's because if you live in Germany and your passports get stolen, you can still get home if you're like in France. If you're in France and you're American, your passports get stolen, you start to panic a little bit.
Absolutely. Because of the EU and the 28 member states, you can travel without having a passport as such. All you need is some sort of identification if they do stop you, but it's free passage. And you're right. As an American, no matter where you are in the world, you're going to need that to travel between countries.
Or to get home, yeah. So let's say you do lose your passport, then the process would be to go to the American embassy or consulate or something as fast as possible so you can get back home?
Yes. And generally, because the consular services and the embassies in these countries have separate sections for passport issuance, they understand that there's going to be lost and stolen passports, so they have a way to get you a passport so you're not delaying your travel plans and can get home. And where I've either had people lose their passport that I'm traveling with or heard stories about it, it's generally between, you can do it in some cases same day, but within 24 hours get it done. So it's always important, not only from the standpoint if it gets lost or stolen, to shut it down so somebody else doesn't use it, but then to have it reissued. They usually process those very quickly.
All right, Michael, appreciate your time. Anything you'd like to add, anything about Experian, anything to kind of final note to all this?
Well, I think the other thing that I say, two other things, especially when traveling, first of all, is make sure that you're not using public Wi-Fi overseas, because you never know. In public Wi-Fi, any information can be seen by the people on public Wi-Fi. And then if you have a hotel safe, whenever you're going out, lock up as many documents or important pieces of information that you don't need to take with you. I always recommend you keep your passport with you, but in other cases, you don't have to carry all your cash or all your credit cards. Have that as a backup and lock them in the hotel safe. Just don't leave them out in the counter. So those would be a couple tips that are really important. And of course, if you want further protection, you can always go to Experian.com/protect and look at our Identity Works product.
All right, Michael, appreciate the advice and the time this morning, and thank you very much for joining us on the podcast and on the radio show.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great day. I appreciate it.
All right, that wraps it up for this episode of Travel with Hawkeye. If there's something you heard on the show and you kind of want more information, go to our Travel with Hawkeye website, travelwithhawkeye.net. Click on blog and just read the blog for this particular podcast episode. Also, don't forget to follow us on our social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Snapface, all those types of things. You can find those also. I'm joking. I know it's Facebook. We have all those things available, links to those at travelwithhawkeye.net. On behalf of everybody who made this part of our Travel with Hawkeye podcast, thank you. And remember, the world is out there for you to explore. Your adventure awaits. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis, and this has been the Travel with Hawkeye podcast.